This is the Prehistory Guys podcast.
I'm Rupert Soskin.
And I'm Michael Bott. Welcome to the latest Prehistory Guys interview, introducing you to top archaeologists and getting them to tell you about their painstaking and groundbreaking work.
Yes, we do try to bring you wide-ranging areas of study, and this month we're delighted to be joined by Professor Duncan Garrow of Reading University.
Indeed we are. And Professor Garrow really has a lot to talk about. We met Duncan at the Landscapes of the Dead conference at the Society of Antiquaries back in November 2019, and we just knew we had to get him on. Apart from being a great speaker, he's another frontline archaeologist who makes you reconsider all sorts of things you thought you knew.
So true. I tell you what, I'll give you a flavour of his CV in a nutshell.
Oh, please do.
Well, Duncan Garrow teaches later European prehistory, with a particular focus on Britain, and archaeological theory. His research interests include the Mesolithic-Neolithic transition, long-term histories of deposition, burial practices, the interpretive potential of radiocarbon dating, the integration of developer-funded and university-based archaeology, archaeological theory, and interdisciplinary approaches to material culture. Duncan worked in the commercial archaeology sector at the Cambridge Archaeological Unit from 1996 to 2002, when he left to undertake his PhD on Neolithic and Early Bronze Age pits in East Anglia. His most recent books include Technologies of Enchantment, Exploring Celtic Art from 400 BC to AD 100, that's 2012 and co-authored with Chris Godson, and Neolithic Stepping Stones, Excavation and Survey Within the Western Seaways of Britain, 2008 to 2014, co-authored with Fraser Sturt. He is currently co-directing with Melanie Giles and Neil Wilkin an AHRC-funded project entitled Grave Goods, Objects and Death in Later Prehistoric Britain, as well as the Neolithic Crannogs project with Fraser Sturt. He's recently directed excavations in the Outer Hebrides, the Channel Islands and the Isles of Scilly, and he's currently working on a book exploring ritual deposition in British prehistory from the Paleolithic through to the Iron Age.
He's written rather a lot of papers too.
That's true. Some interesting titles amidst the books and papers. Artifacts Between Disciplines, The Toothbrush and the Axe. I love that.
Mm. How about Archaeology and Anthropology, Understanding Similarity, Exploring Difference?
Careful, we could be here all day.
Well, it's my favourite, Grey Waters Bright with Neolithic Argonauts, Maritime Connections and the Mesolithic-Neolithic Transition from the Western Seaways of Britain, circa 5,000 to 3,500 BC.
Yeah, and Crannogs. I want to ask him about Crannogs.
I knew you'd want to ask him about Crannogs. We'd best get him on then, hadn't we?
I think we should.
Welcome, Duncan. Welcome to the Prehistory Guys podcast.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. It's great to have
How's things with you today?
They are interesting in these troubled times, is probably the best word.
For anybody listening in the future, I think you probably know what we're talking about.
Yes, we do live in interesting times. That's certainly true.
Yeah, but doing research without easy access to libraries, even in this digital age, is challenging. Because, you know, with archaeology, you do still use quite a lot of books. So that's proving interesting in itself.
So how would you, we've just given you a sort of glowing CV overview thing. How would you introduce yourself, Duncan?
That's a question. I think I'm, in terms of my archaeology, I've always just tried to do what interests me and I feel is important at the time, and I quite like that the sort of winding road that leads me down. I wouldn't say I'm particularly focused, but hopefully focused enough not to be too unfocused is what the path I try to tread. I suppose that perhaps stems back to my Cambridge Archaeological Unit days. When you're digging a development site, you don't get to choose what archaeology you do. And I think that's a great thing, because the archaeology chooses you, as some of my colleagues there used to say.
Yeah.
But it also makes you a bit more open-minded, I think, and ready to find the interest in all sorts of different things that you didn't previously recognise.
Yeah, in the beginning, did archaeology choose you, or did you choose archaeology at the very beginning?
Yeah. I wasn't one of those kids that went out picking up flint when I was seven. I went to Ephesus in Turkey with my family, and when I was about, I don't know, 13, and I remember finding that pretty amazing. And I always liked history and classical world, the kind of stuff about the past that you get at school. I liked outdoor stuff, and so I kind of veered towards archaeology because I wasn't totally sure whether to do history or not. And I quite like the idea of doing something different. So maybe inside me there was a voice saying to do that. And then I loved it from the word go, and especially from when I started digging. It was great.
What was your first dig?
It was Wandlebury Hill Fort, just outside Cambridge. actually, that's the first time I did any digging. I went on a... that was an Iron Age hill fort, and that was great. I mean, the first thing I dug was an Iron Age storage pit full of lovely riches, you know, loads of
pottery. Oh, wow, okay, really. So where was that?
Bone, and just outside Cambridge on our student training excavation that Charlie French was leading. And that was great, and a really cool feature to be digging, and I just enjoyed the whole experience, and I asked to come back the next year when it wasn't my year, but they let me, which was nice. And I sort of slightly accidentally ended up working for the unit in Cambridge after I finished my degree. And I thought I was going to do a PhD, and I didn't get funding for that. But it turns out it was the best thing that could ever happen to me, really, because that changed the course of my archaeological career and taught me so much. And it felt... you know, so disappointing at the time not to get the funding, but you know, many years later, you realize what a great thing it was that
funny
I didn't.
How things turn out.
Interesting. Well, you've certainly tackled some pretty major projects over the years, haven't you? I mean, just reading through the list of your papers is quite impressive. And one of the things that we particularly wanted to talk to you about was all your work on dating the Neolithic through the Western Seaboard. And you know, I'm almost inclined to just toss it at you like that, really, because you know, I'm sure that you know you'd have the best ingredients that you'd want to tell folks.
Yeah. So that project was done jointly with Fraser Sturt at Southampton. I'm sure you know I've worked with a lot, hopefully will do for many years to come. But Fraser and I were. We did our PhDs together, which is where we met. And after that, we were just looking for... we were interested in the way in which the Neolithic arrived in Britain.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you're interested in that question, you have to look across the channel. For that reason, we sort of began to try and get a project off the ground in Guernsey, because it was kind of France, but kind of not. And a little bit easier bureaucratically to get involved with in terms of excavation. We dug at Leray, a great site that actually Barry Cunliffe first fully excavated, and just for 1 year, and had put a marker down as it being an interesting site. So we'd started there with the transition in mind. And then we were just thinking about, you know, how we could build that into a bigger research project and try and, you know, address the question that we were interested in, the process through which the Neolithic moved from the continent to Britain on a bigger scale. And Fraser in particular, because Fraser's a maritime archaeologist, amongst many things, but, you know, he was interested in the sea and the seafaring aspect and got me interested in that. And in the end, we came to realised that people were trying to look at the question of how the Neolithic, this thing called the Neolithic, moved from the continent to Britain across the channel, but no one actually ever looked at the channel. They only ever looked at France or mainland Britain or Ireland. And we thought, I'll tell you what, why do people not really look on islands? And we ended up doing a bit of research there and published that in our Grey Waters with Neolithic Argonauts, Paper in Antiquity.
Great title.
Thank you. Yeah. That was just looking at lots of different islands and the archaeological evidence for mobility across the sea at that time. We realised that people, partly because of development, partly because of all sorts of different reasons, that certain island groups really hadn't seen much archaeological work in relation to the early Neolithic, and we thought we'd try and change that.
Can I just ask in there something that hadn't occurred to me previously, and something that you touch on in the paper, is that how the maritime conditions at the time would have affected the way in which peoples migrating or interacting from the continent would have viewed the potential of the seaways getting to and from Britain mainland or the islands?
Yeah. So I think there's... Fraser would certainly say that too often the sea is drawn as this kind of uniform blue expanse,
yeah,
over which you travel, and then you get to land, and then you have mountains and valleys and things like that. Yeah. And you know, and Fraser would tell us that we need to have some texture on that sea. And I think that really a lot of people weren't really fully aware of that issue. Chris Garr had approached it with Callahan in a paper, which was really interesting that they'd looked at that. But we wanted to take that a bit further and just look at the kind of affordance that the sea gave you. I mean, you know, you can cross the channel on a lilo on a good day, as Fraser always says, and if you choose your day right, it's fine. But there are certain conditions that you need to take into account, and if you're crossing the channel that you know, in paddled craft, which they would have been in the Neolithic, you get swept, you know, tens of miles in one direction because of the tide, and then tens of miles back in the other direction. So when you do things like plot a course across the sea, you're not going from A to B, you're going on this crazy zigzag line.
Am I right in thinking that conditions in the channel would have been slightly more problematic than they are today in terms of the shallowness of it and turbulence?
It was... If we're talking about 4000 BC, it wouldn't have been a million miles away from what it's like now.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was also, you know, it's also important to try and model when the channel formed and what happened over that period, because people, again, that hadn't really been done for archaeology. You know, paleogeomorphologists and people like that were interested in it, but no one. So one of the things that we did on that project was actually just produce an accurate map of sea level through time that no one had done, because the geographers are interested in sea level curves, but they don't really mind. They're not worrying about where people are going to find sites. So it's just producing a map of the sea was one of the things. And you know, sure.
So what were the biggest surprises for you coming out of that project?
Yeah, we had an amazing project to be involved with, because we just got to work in some spectacular places, and it was very logistically involved a lot of logistics. But which seems to be a theme emerging in my work. The plus side of that was you got to work in a really wide variety of places. They're all islands, so they shared similarities, but they were immensely different. And we got to, you know, it was fantastic. Some great archaeology. The surprises, it was very surprising to, it was all a surprise in a way, and I'll elaborate on that. But all of the sites that we looked at had all been found because things had been eroding out of a cliff edge, but no one had a clue what kind of site any of them were. So we had to have a bit of luck to find anything, really. So that was really, really interesting, you know, methodologically from that point of view. But perhaps the biggest surprise was the strange microliths that we got in Scilly. That were more like Northern French or Belgian types than Southern English types. Yeah, and that was of a bit, you know, to the side of what we were actually looking for, but amazing. So we had Hugo Anderson Weimark out digging with us, and he's a lithics expert, and luckily, because he spots them and goes, these look a bit odd. and gradually emerged through discussions with various continental experts that they were a certain type. So it seems there's a material connection between, you know, northern France and Belgium across to Scilly, which is a very odd kind of link. But that was that was really surprising.
Yeah.
And the site in Uist was it's hard because it was a very heavily eroded island off the main coast of Uist. And it was so the archaeology was challenging, but it had lots of intrigue in its pottery assemblage and its sequence, actually. So, but I won't go into detail there. It's too technical. I hope that's enough surprises. And I suppose maybe another surprise was how hard it was to find what you really wanted to find. Mm-hmm. Which Alison Sheridan, I think you spoke to her a little while back. But she
did,
she said exactly that in her book review of the monograph that we produced. Like, it's just hard to... So we didn't particularly find really early Neolithic site. We found early Neolithic in the broad sense, but none of them were, you know, chronologically very early, and that's really what we're after. But the archaeological record is what it is, so perhaps there isn't anything like that. But and of course we were aware that we might not do that, but it was trying and then failing really was a good learning experience. But you got some great archaeology, so it wasn't a failure in that way.
So how did the archaeology, so how did what you've found doing this project feed into your ideas about the Mesolithic Neolithic transition?
It was hard because we did a lot of radiocarbon dating as well, and that was involving sites that weren't just ones we dug but ones that lots of different people had dug previously that we thought might be beneficial to date, and it was beneficial. You know, we dated, I can't remember how many sites it was, but it's 50 different radiocarbon dates that we got, new ones, as part of that project. In a way, the results that we got fitted with the conventional narrative that Alistair Whittle and colleagues had produced previously. And I shouldn't be disappointed with fitting in with the conventional narrative, because maybe it tells us that that's right. But it's all, it's always slightly disappointing to not challenge things a little bit, if you know what I mean. All of our islands, they're in the sort of more peripheral zone away from the earliest Neolithic that they defined, which was in the southeast of England. So it kind of backed up that narrative really nicely, which is great. I shouldn't feel disappointed in that. But it also, it kind of reminded you that of the bias of excavation in the southeast relative to where we were looking, and it made us think about the effects that might have had on our understanding of chronology. And that's a project that we've never got around to doing, but it'd be nice to address that a bit more one day.
Never enough time.
Yeah, there isn't.
One thing I did take away, though, from the paper, Duncan, is that I hadn't realised this before, but the islands show later date for the intrusion of the Neolithic package, if you like, than the mainland. And what I took away was that, in your view, that reflected a very much more nuanced idea of the exchange between Mesolithic and Neolithic, the hunter-gatherers and the continent, that both sides would have been responsible for the exchange, that, you know, it wasn't just pressure from the continent of migrants coming in, that, you know, it was a two-way exchange, and so the transition is more nuanced than we are perhaps given to understand.
That's right, and I think that, you know, since we did that work, all the ancient DNA stuff's come out, which is very much putting back on the agenda large-scale migration from the continent, as I'm sure you know. And in a way, that makes it even more important to have a look at these places where that perhaps that doesn't clearly fit. So those microliths that I was talking about earlier that we found in Scilly, they suggest that there's some kind of contact in the 5th millennium, so before any Neolithic happens anywhere in Britain. And there was back and forth, but it didn't result in seemingly in large scale gene pool transformation, yeah, or the arrival of lots of Neolithic things and objects. And I think you have to, in that circumstance, you have to make the most of the tiny glimpses that you get, because it's a difficult process, yeah, to see archaeologically.
It's kind, yeah, of tantalising, given where the Scillies are, that they're on that western edge there, which sort of suggests that thoroughfare, rounding of that corner off Cornwall, is probably quite a thing.
Yeah.
But we don't know, so yeah, it just remains tantalising,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Exactly.
I guess.
I think one of the very important things for me that came out of particularly, you know, listening to you giving talks, that something that we've talked about a lot is the fact that we need to get rid of these badges, you know, where we talk about Mesolithic, Neolithic, Bronze Age, Iron Age, as if they are these sudden changes, as opposed to these really possibly sometimes very slow transitions between one way of life and another. And that, looking at the so whether it's the transition up the seaboard of, you know, how different cultures are coming into mainland Britain from the continent, or indeed anywhere else, we'll talk about your work on grave goods later on, but that's another interesting point, is this transition between but these fundamentally different ways of being, as opposed to these broad bands that we make, it's as if you step over a line and you're into a,
yeah,
new age, when that's entirely not the case.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that you have to always stop yourself when you're saying that you talk about Neolithic people, because it's just a silly thing to say, really, because they never thought of themselves as Neolithic. It doesn't have a meaning in terms of the prehistoric past. They were just people, and they might have been doing what we now see as Neolithic things. It's a tricky one. And of course, as archaeologists, we have to look at firm categories to be able to do analysis. And perhaps we'll talk about that later, because that's, yeah, I think, perhaps annoyingly, for everyone, in lots of what I've done in my work, it's looked at categories and seen where the edges blur into other things. And I think it's actually interesting to look at those blurry bits, because that's where you can understand the core of the middle bits of the area that you draw the line about better.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
So talking about blurry bits, Rupert... No, it wasn't personal.
Yeah, where are you going? Where are you going? What are we doing?
Well, I thought you might like to return us to Uist and Crannogs.
Yes. A lot of our listeners know I have a bit of a soft spot for Crannogs, and I know that you've been doing some pretty good work on Crannogs, and you're about to, all things being equal, you're about to kick off and do some more.
What I'm saying is, Crannogs, what in your mind, Rupert, your personal view, is a Crannog is, because not everybody will have thought about, given time to thinking about Crannogs at
this
all.
This is true. I was actually going to toss that to Duncan for his description. We had a thing when we were filming Standing with Stones, and I really wanted to film a sequence of just rowing out across a loch in the early mists of a foggy morning, you know, and just rowing out to a Crannog. It never happened. We couldn't do it, but it's something I still want to do. But the thing is that having, you know, your research and a lot of the new discoveries that have been coming out that have really pushed the dating back of these man-made islands out in the middle of lochs, up in the Highlands and Islands. Particularly, I should toss it to you to talk about, you know, the discoveries of a lot of these pots, ceramic items that have been placed in the lock whole. They haven't been broken and tossed in as rubbish. And so go on, tell us about that side of things that you're working with there, because it's a fascinating new bit of research.
So it's a long story, but I'll try and keep it short. All of the work that it's a project that I've been doing with Razor again. All of the work that we've been doing, we've been mainly
Can we define Cranach, though? That's what I was trying to
Rupert did okay. He kept it simple.
I did keep it simple.
Yeah. Artificial islands in lochs. Yeah. There's been like in many things with archaeology, there's been a lot of debate about what is a Cranach and what isn't, and sometimes life's too short to worry too much about that. But some degree of artificiality is quite important. But as we've found in what we've been doing, sometimes it's an augmentation of a natural feature. One of the sites that we've been looking at, there's a rocky crag poking out of the surface of the loch. So they've seen that natural island, and then they've piled a lot of stones around it to make an artificial and to enhance that natural with artificial. But on other sites, in our case, again, they've piled stones purely on the bottom of the loch and made a big pile that came out above the surface of the water without any natural island helping them. In the lowlands, you get wooden crannogs much more, and they're more like the kind of stilt lake dwelling type things that perhaps.
And people, that's what I was getting around to, because I think that's the image, if anybody knows anything about Cranach, that's the image that comes to mind, thanks to places like the Cranach Centre on Lochte.
Isn't that interesting? You see, the thing that comes to my mind is the
stony ones, too.
That's what I was trying to get, extrapolate. It's important to get
those. Clearly, those are quite different things when you think about the construction process. You know, if you're going to create a raised stilted dwelling on it out of timber, it's a very different thing to piling a load of rocks around a natural crag. Who's to say whether those people that did those two different things had the same if they thought they were doing the same thing as each other, or if they didn't, one of the things that has always puzzled people a little bit about Cranachs is their variety, their multi-period character. So you get them in, as it turns out, from the Neolithic right through to the post-medieval period. And all of those things get called Cranachs because of that vagueness of definition, that it's really just an artificial island. Sometimes they have dwellings on, but that doesn't really have to be the case for them to be called Cranachs, that kind of
thing. So, Duncan, tell the story of your way into this and what occurred.
Yeah, so we got involved because directly because of Alison Sheridan, actually, again. She cropped something
in. Oh, really?
She knew we were doing the dating program that I mentioned earlier, and she had some material from these sites, and she said, "Oh, I've got this new material. Do you want to date it?" And it totally fitted with our research aim. So we said yes, and we did. So that was good. But at that point, no one had a brilliant idea of the kind of location that this material had come from. So Alison put us in touch with Chris Murray, who lives locally in Stornoway in the Isle of Lewis. And Chris is a man of very many talents and abilities, amongst which are scuba diving, and being extremely careful whilst doing that, not least because he was once a Royal Navy diver, so probably had to be very careful with the things that he was trying to handle there. So Chris was out walking his dog one day, as he did, saw a Cranach in a loch, and being a curious fellow, thought, "I wonder what that is. I wonder if there's any stuff. I'll get my diving gear and dive around it," as you do. And it's a lot of kit to lug. So anyway, Chris did dive around this island, found some pottery. he took it to his friend Mark Elliott, who worked at the museum, because he wanted to report what he'd found, and he also wanted to find out what it was. And Mark said, "That's interesting. That looks like Neolithic pottery, not Iron Age or whatever we think." So they embarked on a Google Earth mission to find more sites, and amazingly dived a lot of sites and found Neolithic pottery on several. So anyway, that was the background, the work that Chris and Mark did. And so we got in touch with Chris and we said, we'd like to come and do some more archaeological work with a capital A on these sites. So we went up to see Chris and he took us around and showed us, and we then understood the kind of site that we were talking about. We really, at the beginning, we didn't even know that they were crannogs. All of this material had come from crannogs.
Yeah.
So we were then able to get some funding and to do some underwater geophysics and to do some archaeological diving and recover more information and take some environmental cores and that kind of thing, and do a small amount of excavation on one of the sites, the one that has the natural crag. And we've just we're just starting an Arts and Humanities Research Council funded project called Islands of Stone that Fraser's leading on. And we're working with Angela Gannon, who's based at Historic Environment Scotland. And they've got a load of people there who are really have got so many different varied skills to offer the project. And yeah, they're really very supportive. So it's going to be great fun working with them. So we're going to be digging one really good site and finding, hopefully, a load more to demonstrate that there are Neolithic crannogs right across the Outer Hebrides.
How many sites have you been able to look at?
Yeah,
so
we've looked in detail at three. We've dug only one, and we're going to be digging one of the others that we've looked at in detail. Chris has found six. And then something I haven't talked about because the background is so lengthy, but Ian Armit, who's at York now, dug what he thought at the beginning was an Iron Age site in the 1980s in North Uist, and straight away they realised it was there was loads of Neolithic pottery. It wasn't Iron Age.
Wow.
So that
wow.
after they did that excavation in the 80s at Island Dawn. Everyone said, oh, maybe there are more Neolithic crannogs, because they found one which was definitely had Neolithic occupation on it. But then no one found any more. So everyone said, oh, maybe it's a one-off random site. So what Chris demonstrated was that it wasn't. And what we want to demonstrate even more widely is that it is widespread across the Outer Hebrides and potentially Scotland, who knows?
Tell us about the fact that a lot of the ceramics, if not all of the ceramics, appear to have been deliberately placed in the waters as opposed to tossed in as rubbish.
Yeah, so that's a hard one to answer. So some of the pots are, you know, immense. Then there's never been a totally complete one, but if you're chucking a pot in a loch, it's going to break anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So some of the pots that we've got out and that Chris got out, you know, like 2/3 to 3/4 complete, which is an amazing thing to see when you're a Neolithic archaeologist, because you're not used to seeing that kind of material.
Yes.
Because you don't get pots in burials very much.
No. Bling.
So you're not getting, you know, in the early Bronze Age, you're used to seeing whole beakers and whole collodones all the time, but that's just not what you see in the Neolithic. So that's pretty amazing. Loads of material around the islets, sometimes massive, not always massive, but the one site we've dug has very little material on the island, so it seems like whatever they're doing there is ending up in large vessels being in the water and not very much being on the island, which suggests that they're intentionally chucking it off into the water for purposes which remain to be pinned down.
When we're looking at the whole at Uist and Lewis, Rupert and I just recorded actually a short podcast, a shortage podcast, about Callanish and some of the work that's been done there recently. When we're looking at the whole thing, bearing in mind that Callanish encompasses 14, 15 sites in an immediate vicinity on Lewis. Should we be looking, including the Crannogs, in that kind of dating, that period, or not?
Yeah, so the sites, we've got quite a good tight bracket of radiocarbon dates. From around 3,500 to 3,200 BC.
Okay.
For our sites. And obviously that's just the dates we've got so far, but that's from about four or five sites. And so that's slightly before, it's the phase before Callanish kicks off.
Yeah.
And the couple of sites we've looked at, and they're only, you know, like, I think it's something like 5, 6, 7 kilometres away from Callanish. Yeah. So really quite near. So depending on what we find our Crannogs to be, if we ever resolve that complicated thorny issue, it could provide whatever they are. It doesn't really matter. They're a crucial piece of the jigsaw of the prehistoric Neolithic past that precedes Callanish, which leads up to ultimately the construction of all that vast monumental complex in that part of Lewis. So it's really important for understanding the origins of that site, you know, not necessarily because there's a direct link between the kinds of site that they are, but just in terms of our understanding of what people are choosing to do in that landscape with stone. They're moving stones around, so they got good practice about that.
That's a good point, actually. You said that lightly, moving stone around. But not at all. I mean, that they represent a huge amount of work and a massive labour, don't they? I think that's something I hadn't kind of realised before as well.
That's right. And when you've got when you've got massive stones like you have at Callanish, it looks more like a huge amount investment of labour. Although sometimes people think perhaps they were just erecting stones that were found in that immediate location, but still, it's a massive. Sure. Physical effort to have done that, whereas the stones we're talking about are smaller. They're just about handleable between two or three people, but there's thousands of tons of them, and they're out in the middle of a lot. One day, Fraser and I will get around to doing some kind of calculation about the weight. We tried it once, and then we completely bamboozled ourselves with Googling things about the weight of granite that we gave up. But one day, we're going to work it out, and we'll say it took this many person hours to pile this big load of stones up in the middle of a loch. But, you know, the logistics of moving stones out across the water... and keeping that site manageable, because they're kind of 20 metres across at the base and up about 4 metres high. It's a huge, big thing, you know. It looks like some of the Neolithic chambered tombs that you get around the same time if you took it out of the water and placed it onto land. So it's really interesting, And they're definitely monumental. I think you were kind of hinting at that, Michael. And
Well, it's the man hours, you know.
Yeah.
It's no mean feat.
I mean, the more you think about it, the scarier it is, the idea
crazier
of having
it
done
is,
that.
Yes. And then you really begin to... Sorry, Rupert. I was just going to say, then you really do begin to think about the drivers.
Yeah.
Sorry, Rupert.
Yeah. No, that's all right, because I'm just, you know, conscious of time as well and thinking that I'm going to... I'm going to... move forward, actually, because I think one of the biggest projects that you've been on for some time now is about grave goods, and you know, you gave a wonderful lecture at the Landscapes of the Dead conference last year, and I must admit, so many eye openers for us, just aspects of just ways of seeing things, really, or trying to understand things that certainly we hadn't considered before. So, in fact, I think one of the biggest things for me coming out of that, just to launch you into this, one of the comments that you made was about the multi-temporal usage of sites makes grave goods invisible. And it was just that, you know, it was such a simple statement and such a, oh yeah, okay, no, I can see what you're saying. But but you you know, you just have done so much work on analysing burial practices and grave goods. So I'm just going to kick you off on that because we've got a lot of questions.
Yeah, you're right. And so ever since the beginning, it's felt like a project that you could, there's no end to what you could do. It's just this, the grave goods are such a rich resource.
And the beginning was, what, 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Yeah, three and a half years ago, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So luckily, we've had a fairly big team. So it's a project that I've been running with Mel Giles at Manchester and Neil Wilkin at the British Museum. And we're lucky enough to have had Amryn Cooper and Katrina Gibson doing most of the work. and they've been collecting the data about all those sites and certainly writing stuff too. I don't mean they've just been collecting data, but they did the really hard work. And one of the drivers that we always wanted to have in place from the start was to get that kind of substantial body of data behind us so that we could really say things on the basis of empirical information. And also one of the things that's allowed us to do is to really get to know the finds and not just to go to the same old things that everyone always talks about when they're talking about grave goods. So the more the project's gone on, the more all of us, I think, have felt that the key thing that we're trying to do is to bring the everyday grave goods to the fore and not just focus too much on those fantastic ones that we see in picture books. Really that's the nub of what putting objects with dead people was all about in the prehistoric past. So that's been a great thing to be able to do and find some of the funny things that, you know, that people put in, the subtle things.
So the context for setting off with the grave goods project is that in the past we've tended to concentrate on the fancy stuff, your words, or you know the bling, the stuff that you know naturally springs out as "Ooh, I like that," and ignore the broad context of, you know, what's actually been put in with the dead and buried.
That's right.
So what have you done to extrapolate that information? Because you're creating a whole new database.
Yeah, good question.
That's the point, isn't it? Yeah.
So what we were very keen to do from the start was to capture everything that got put in graves. So that we haven't said yet, but the project starts at the beginning of the Neolithic, so 4000 BC-ish, and ends at the end of the Iron Age, so AD 43. So the point was to look in the long term so that we really got some insight into the ebbs and flows of what's going on, that kind of thing. And what we wanted to do was to capture all objects that went in graves. And we weren't stupid enough to try and do that for the whole of Britain throughout the whole of time. We toyed with that idea for a while and we thought, no, we can't really do that. So we chose six case study areas around Britain and then did everything within those.
What's that? That's Kent, Dorset,
Cornwall and Scilly, Anglesey and Gwynedd. East Yorkshire Orkney and the Outer Hebrides, which I sneakily called one case study area. You'll notice a heavily coastal distribution to our case study area sites and the inclusion of several island groups, which I was not meaning to do, but somehow it just happened. I didn't have to tell Mel we're going to do that, but it just sort of happened. So that's good. But so we've tried to capture all the information that's given us, you know, you can properly say, all right, when are people putting pots in graves and how much does it happen? When does it happen that people start putting cremated bodies in pots as opposed to inhumations with pots by the side of them? Can you investigate how those two things relate? Whatever crazy things do they put with people and that kind of stuff. Rupert, you were saying, so the Neolithic, which is what I was talking about at the conference that I met you both at, was the Neolithic's tricky because it just doesn't behave in the way that grave goods should behave. It makes you hurt, scratch your head, which perhaps, you know, the more I engaged with it, the more I liked it for that, as I said earlier about, you know, sort of pushing at the edges of those blurry boundary categories. You were saying that I'd said about time kind of making grave goods disappear, and that, looking at that evidence and trying to think it through, it takes... That's something I've always tried to do since I first did my PhD looking at pits, and was to try and let the material, to try and properly understand those material dynamics of the past and what that's telling you about practice. And that seems kind of obvious, but I'm not sure we always take enough time to do that. And once you looked, you could see, and the example I gave was a really clear example, which was... you could see that pots had gone in whole and had kind of been broken as they got moved and new bodies were added. And it got me wondering whether the same kind of thing had happened elsewhere. It's just that it had happened so much that those grave goods had got you know, mangled through the process of practice. And we can still see, and people, I think, had got, you know, myself included, absolutely, that we'd all got blinded by the fascinating human remains that are evident in many Neolithic tombs, and lost sight of those scrappy bits of material culture, which are a scrappy, but only because of the way in which things happened. I hope I'm making sense. Yeah.
Well, there's another case that you mentioned specifically, and that was at the Tomb of the Eagles, where the pottery had been taken outside and burned and then put back again.
Yeah.
And that's something I'd never heard of that before. And I wondered, you know, is that something that is that unique to that site, or is that something that you've seen elsewhere?
Yeah. I mean, that was John Hedges who wrote up the site originally. It was his, he made that argument. But certainly, you know, in talking to Katrina, who's gathered a lot of the data for Orkney, that's definitely something she would emphasise, I think, in terms of that you get just this burnt material. Whether or not it's necessarily taken out of the tomb and burnt and then brought back in, as Hedges was arguing, is on every site is open to discussion. But there's things going on that are messing it about, that are burning it. So you get burnt human bone in these sites, but probably sometimes it's not intentional cremation as such. It's that the bones are getting caught up in the fires of whatever they're doing it for, ritual pollution, cleaning, that, whatever, if you want to use that kind of phraseology. But they're doing all sorts of weird things in those tombs. They're not just putting bodies in.
So the lesson for us approaching it is not to think of them in our own terms of sepulchral sites, but something that's happening there that's dynamic.
Yeah, that's really nicely put. Yeah, absolutely. And they're very dynamic places. And I think that you're right that, you know, that we're not the first people to say this, but those Neolithic collective tombs are places that, in a way, a tomb is a bad word for it. And they're, like you were saying, Michael, that there's lots of different things happening at one thing of which is burial, but there's all sorts of different things going on involving the interaction with the human remains that people are coming into. That's not to do with burial, it's to do with interacting with dead bodies and bits of bone, which is more complicated than that. So and we've got this set, you know, that's the way we understand the dead. And as ever, we want that prehistoric archaeology to challenge our own understandings and make us realise that we're weird, really, not them.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah, it's important to make it do that always, yeah.
I think one of the things that we can never escape, really, is that we've developed such a sanitised world, and we don't really think about how unbelievably awful those places must have smelt.
Yeah, it's not a great thought, is it? I know. But perhaps that was, you know, that was part of their point. And again, people were used to that kind of thing. And it's a bit like when we were talking about seafaring earlier, Oh, it must have been dangerous going across the sea in those skin boats. And if we did it, it'd be really scary and dangerous. But that was just what they did. That was how you got across the sea. So in a way, that is a different kind of normal. And I think it's important to always bear that in mind when you're thinking about the past. And well, I'm not saying they would have smelt lovely to them, but perhaps it was more a desired part of their lives. I don't know.
Who knows?
As we know, they're a bit weird.
Well, the other part of the normal is, you know, that their lifespan was considerably shorter. And yet we tend to think, you know, when we're looking back into the past, we tend to think in very broad timescales, you know, of, you know, tens, hundreds, not quite thousands. But we were talking to Mike Allen last week, and his research, you know, gives the lie to this continual use thing. You know, things were made, people had an excited idea about what they were doing at the time, then they may have gone off, they may have let it alone for a bit. Things come in ebbs and flows, and what people are thinking about at the time, that traditions don't necessarily last for hundreds of years, and continued use does not mean continued use in the same way or the same attitude.
Yeah, and this other side of that coin, or a related issue that it made me think about, was one of the things that's come out of Grave Goods Project is the regionality as well, that a period isn't the same, and especially with grave goods, because it's such a, you know, at one level a very personal and localized thing that's happening, that people are just doing things quite differently, you know, at certain times in their own way. They a certain material becomes important for in Cornwall in the Bronze Age, you know, like quartz or sandstone in Dorset, you know, they're putting it's local, and it's not just because it's there, it's important because it's local, and that kind of thing really, really comes out and reminds you that people aren't the same, and they weren't the same across the Bronze Age or whatever, that there is lots of different things possible to do.
Wanted to ask you about a couple of graphs that sort of leapt out in their implications. Right, Rupert, do you want to ask about the regularity?
We're talking about the same graphs, I'm sure, but you show really it was a marked range of peaks and troughs going from early Bronze Age, and then
early Neolithic, Bronze Age.
Yes, I mean early Neolithic. You know, the comparatively low amounts of grave goods. Yeah. Well, we know grave goods, but then surging up to this massive peak of burials with a kind of, I don't know, intermediate range of grave goods, and then that dipping right down again, and then
it drops
back
off
up
a cliff.
The
That's
Age.
The extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
It's
what's
just,
that about?
Yeah.
Good question. No, absolutely, it's amazing, isn't it, when you look at it in that scale, which is, you know, we wanted to do that. And so the early Bronze Age, they really, you know, as we know, they really go to town, and they have amber and gold and jet and loads of pottery and everything like that. That's not necessarily as we've kind of already discussed what everyone had in all their graves. They probably mostly just had a pot. There is a lot going on there, and there's a lot of material moving around. And then, as you say, as you go through into the Middle Bronze Age, so from about 1500 BC onwards, you're getting, it's quite really interesting, because actually the number of pots you get per century is more than the early Bronze Age. But there's nothing else going in graves, really. They just have pots. And it's partly about a transition to cremation, but it's also just they're not wanting to put fancy things in graves, an argument that Richard Bradley and others have made for a long time is that you've got to understand grave goods in relation to other depositional practices, and in this case, hoarding. So putting loads of metal objects in the ground is very popular at that time.
Yeah.
So there's some kind of relationship between what you put in a grave and whether you're doing hoarding or not. But obviously they're not directly comparable things. They're only comparable from our perspective, really. But there is some relationship, and it's interesting to try and tease that out.
Is there any kind of zeitgeist thinking about those intermediate low levels of burials occurring?
Yeah.
Especially between the Bronze Age and the
late Bronze Age and early Iron Age. Not much is happening. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Is that a reflection of population levels or something else?
It's one of the things that we're doing. I know what you're saying, but probably not. It is just a reflection of the archaeological visibility of the practices that we see. So one of the things that Neil and Amwin are doing for the Grave Goods book is to look at this issue of how burials relate to hoards and finds on settlements as well. And I won't go into too much detail, but to answer your question, Michael, if you had another graph and you saw hoards, it would be going whizzing up to the sky at around, a similar time to when those burials whizzed down to the floor. But really loads more objects in hoards.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah.
So people are investing their material in not in graves, and they're not really investing anything in graves because you don't get that many. So people must be being burnt and scattered on the fields or chucked in rivers.
Absolutely fascinating. Mm. Duncan, you just mentioned the book, and I was going to say that the project has many strands as endgames.
Yeah.
It's not just a gathering together of a database. It has many aims.
That's right.
And many uses for this database that we're going to see, become public and available. Do you want to speak to those?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Different things.
Yeah, absolutely. So... We have done all sorts of other different things. So we've changed some of the galleries in the British Museum. So that's something that Neil in particular is working on. People can follow a grave goods trail. And one of the motivations for doing that was really a realization as we discussed, lots of those amazing finds are from graves in museums, the kind of thing that makes it into the British Museum. But in a way that the greatness of that object has made us lose sight of its context in a museum situation. So people would see those great objects, but they wouldn't necessarily know that they were in a grave, and they wouldn't necessarily have been given the opportunity to have archaeologists telling them about the great stories that might lie behind those objects. So we tried to bring that out. And we also produced some schools information packs, which we're really to help teachers teach prehistory. So in those we got some fantastic new artist reconstructions, and Michael Rosen, the children's poet, wrote some poems who we're all thinking of, who's not very well at the moment and wishing his best. He wrote some fantastic poems that really, and he's done some great videos on his YouTube channel of them, of him reading them out and talking about the Neolithic and the Bronze Age, which is just amazing to hear. And we're hoping that he's got such an amazingly wide and loyal following because of his talent. just to try and help, we hope he's going to help people learn about these amazing burials that we just want people to find out about and to engage with, and it's often hard for them to have a chance to do that. So with a bit of luck, it's done that too.
I was just saying to Rupert before we started that one of the aims of working with the British Museum, what I take away is that people crowd into the Egyptian sections of the British Museum and sort of nowhere to be seen in the British prehistory section,
And
not looking at the stuff from their own backyard.
No, that's right. I know we're biased, but it is sad. Neil's got some great images that show that exact thing that he just talks about, of crowds packed up against mummies and then just like tumbleweed blowing through the British Free History yeah. Gallery. And so many people do yeah. just walk through that gallery as a yeah, corridor. Yeah. So as part of what we've been doing, we conducted interviews with people that were walking through the gallery and looking at the trail and things to try and get a sense of people's motivations and perceptions of the gallery and of grave goods as well. So that's been really interesting too.
It's lack of story though, isn't it? You know, it's the fact that we have such a wealth of, you know, I mean, just the narratives that we have around whether it's ancient Egypt or Greece or, you know, what have you, that people have engaged with the notion of people, whereas our own prehistory is still, well, you know, this is very sadly missing. You know, we need to put an awful lot more effort into telling those stories.
Yeah, and I think it's just that the Egyptians have had a better press in the British public imagination.
It's for 150 years.
Yeah, but, and I think it's partly because
they did things in colour.
Yeah.
That helped.
That's true. Yeah. That is true.
Yeah. But I think the great thing is that if British prehistory gets taught more in primary schools, just people will have some sense of it, which, you know, literally until the last 10 years, that they may have gone through their entire education never even thinking about prehistory. So, you know, that's what we've been keen to facilitate, is to people's learning about that. And once they learn, start thinking and come into contact with it, there's no doubt that they'll be, you know, they'll be as amazed as we all are about, well, maybe not quite as amazed as us, but, you know, similarly amazed by these
stories. They should be. You know, it's an interesting thing. When you look at sites like, you know, Must Farm, for example. So you can actually see how people were living as opposed to, you know, random things that might be found.
Yeah.
How people were living. And if you think back, you know, when we were kids, if we were taught anything about prehistory, then it was always, you know, people dressed in skins and being like savages and, you know,
being civilized by the Romans.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And so when you get sites like Must Farm that completely turn that on, that notion on its head visibly, and it's stuff like that, you know, kids should be made aware of this. I'm sure a lot more children would be fired up by prehistory if they fully understood, you know, any of those aspects.
We've just got to give the opportunity. Yeah, I think, because the interesting stuff is there.
So what should our listeners be looking out for to come out, you know, that they can access from this project?
Yeah, so from Grave Goods, we've had, so in all of the academic outputs that we're producing will be open access, so anyone can get hold of them, and they can look via the Prehistoric Grave Goods website. It's on the Reading blog.
Okay.
So we've had one paper out in Proceedings of the Prehistoric Society, and we've got another one coming out in a journal called Archaeological Dialogues, and then there'll be the book, which will be an open access monograph. So it'll be a book that people can buy. But it will also be a thing that you can download for free off the internet. But that's not going to be.
Will the book be entitled "Objects and Death in Later Prehistoric Britain"?
It will probably even very similarly titled to the project title. Yeah, exactly. Grave Goods, Objects and Death. Exactly. And with a bit of luck, that'll be out. Maybe not people's Christmas present this year, but maybe the one after. You keep your fingers crossed.
Cool. Cool. And as far as the British Museum is concerned,
so at the British Museum, this idea of a grave goods trail is going to be rolled out a bit more widely, including within the Egyptian gallery we were just talking about, because some of the finds, even those great finds from Egypt, lots of them are for graves and people wouldn't necessarily know. So we're just trying to get that idea of context across to people. And then the school's resources have been available for a while via the Grave Goods website on the Archaeology Data Service. So people can check that out or check the website Do you want me to read the website web address? Is that?
We can also put the link in the comments below, or what have you, on the page. Duncan's been a real pleasure talking to you. Hopefully, we'll be able to do it again. Is there anything we've missed? We've covered, you know, quite a lot of ground there. I'm sure, of course, there's stuff we've missed, or that we can come back to it later.
We should.
That'll do nicely.
We should make this. we should make this the first of however many. Really.
Please do. Let's see what we get on those Crannogs, eh? Yeah.
Well, do you know what? We shall say this to our listeners, because our listeners know that we have, it's just simmering on a back burner at the moment. But at some point, we will be making a film about Callanish, and you're going to be doing work on the Crannogs up on Lewis. So I just think it would be rude if we don't bring those two things together and make sure that we're on Lewis at the same time.
Yeah, let's do that,
Duncan. It has been eye-opening in many ways. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you for giving me time to talk about archaeology. It's always nice. And for listening.
So that's it. Well, thank you again to our listeners for listening and being a support and giving us feedback, and our Patreon supporters for making it all possible. And with that, we will say bye-bye until the next time. It's bye-bye from me.
And goodbye from me.